I'm turning now to the book of Daniel and chapter 6, verse 1. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. So now Babylon has fallen. Darius has been appointed by Cyrus, the Persian conqueror, to be the king of Babylon and that region, Darius the Mede. He's described in the previous chapter, the very last verse, as being 62 years of age. He is the general through whose wisdom the city of Babylon actually fell. Now, though a Mede, he's reigning a considerable part of the Empire of Persia. He's strictly the governor of Babylon and the regions beyond the rivers. There's a lot of debate as to precisely who this Darius is. He's not the same as a slightly later king and a great king. He is a general. I'm not going to hazard a name this evening because great authorities have settled on different real persons, but Darius appears to be a throne name adopted by him, and not surprisingly, since he is not a royal and he's an under king under the overall jurisdiction of Cyrus. But anyway, Darius at 62, which is very old for those times, is now organizing things in Babylon. And immediately we're told about the 120 princes. Whether that was his doing or whether he was largely picking up on an administration that was already in being, just changing many of the persons, it's hard to say. But that's how things are organized, and it's important for us to know at the very beginning. Now, this chapter in the book of Daniel has come in for a great deal of abuse by critics. The whole scheme of things has been described as preposterous. It's an absurd fiction and story. That's generally the line. It's a kind of rerun, so it's said, of chapter 3. Well, there are certainly some similarities with what happens in chapter 3. But there are far more differences and very significant ones. But it's a most intelligent piece of literature with everything very considered. It's obviously, we believe, by Daniel himself, but he doesn't write in the first person. This is the famous Aramaic part of the book of Daniel from during the course of chapter 2 to the end of this chapter 7 is in Aramaic and then reverts to Hebrew. There are all manner of theories for that too. And the most common among them is that this is in Aramaic because it was the part of the book written while Daniel was in captivity in Babylon, and the remainder of the book, the recording of all the visions and the prophecies, was in Hebrew, either because he was back in Judah, or because he was writing for principally Jewish Judean audience into the future. And so he changed it back into Hebrew. But the book is by him, though this chapter is not in the first person, because it's Daniel's characteristic modesty. He doesn't write as from himself. But let's come into the passage. It is just what we would expect in the book of Daniel, which is, in the narrative parts, largely about hostility and opposition and persecution. Daniel chapter 3, the proposed or intended genocide of all faithful Jews, and it was averted by miracle. And that's the theme that continues right in to this sixth chapter. It's the story of the Bible. And we often say It's one of the great recognizable organizing principles of the Bible. The great war between the world and the church, between the world under the direction of the prince of the power of the air and the people of God. It's a great cable. It runs right through the Bible when we were studying Genesis and Exodus and so on quite recently. We saw it dominates the book of Genesis. What's it about? From the earliest chapters, one of the great themes is the war between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And so it continues. And that war, that theme, is kept up right through the Bible. It's not the only cable or sense or theme running through the Bible, but it's one of the major ones, the church versus the world. And I'd like to turn you for a few seconds, just to refresh your minds on this, before we look at chapter 6, to Revelation chapter 12, where the theme is picked up all the way through the last book of the Bible. And in Revelation 12 and verse 4, we read, "And his tail..." I'll read from verse 3. "There appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven." And any Bible believer can see the imagery of the vision here, and how Satan is drawing down fallen angels. And verse 4, "His tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman," which is the church. In this case, the typical church of the Old Testament. "The dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered." Because right through the Old Testament, the seed of the woman, the coming Christ, is going to be born, and his bloodline runs through that Jewish nation. "He stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to deliver her child, devour her child as soon as it was born." Satan's antagonism against the promise of a Saviour, trying to destroy the church so that it would never happen, and trying to destroy him even before he appeared. Verse 5, "And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne." The 5th verse of Revelation chapter 12, where you have the incarnation of Christ and the ministry of Christ and the death and resurrection of Christ all in one verse. And verse 6, "Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. That's the famous 3.5 years, the time and times and half a time of the book of Revelation, which denotes the last age on earth between the first and second comings of Christ, the present gospel age. And there the church is pursued by the enemy, still to this day. And then I just read 2 more verses and we're done with this. But verse 11, "And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death." There'll always be persecution. And verse 13, "When the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman." Now it's the New Testament church, "which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place." So we're in the world, but not of it, where she is nourished, and here comes the time signature again, for a time and times and half a time, from the face of the serpent. It runs right through the Bible. The battle between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. So we're not surprised to find the warning and the picture in Daniel chapter 6 once again. Now, if you don't believe those things, and you don't believe the scheme of the Bible and its running theme, or a major running theme, and what it's about, then you can't make head nor tail of the book of Daniel. You find the narrative parts up to chapter 6 like fairy tales. They have no depth, no weight, no sense, because you don't understand the whole Bible. But once you see that this is about two nations, two kingdoms, two peoples at war, then you understand it. And the warning and the picture is coming once again, just as we might expect. Now, I'm going to proceed with these verses, and you'll see the deep intelligence of the passage. We've been through chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar was humbled, and chapter 5, where Belshazzar attempts to set back all the decrees that have been passed by the former Babylonian emperor to give religious liberty to the Jews and freedom to them to practice their religion. And Belshazzar unites with this attack upon it all, great profanity and insolence. But of course, God has ordained that as he does that very thing, it will be the last night of the empire. Well, now, this sixth chapter. Darius clearly knows of Daniel, verse 2. He appoints three presidents, and Daniel is made the first. He knows his reputation. He knows his past service. I think he must know how he has predicted the fall of the empire and the manner in which it would fall and the division of the empire to the Medes and the Persians, and he has a great respect for him. Now don't in this chapter imagine for a moment that Darius is converted. He's a polytheist from beginning to the end, and you have to always bear in mind with the polytheism of those days that you did respect each other's gods. And so, although he believes in his own Median gods, he also believes in the gods of the other nations as well. So they all recognize and find some place for each other's gods. And his attitude to Daniel and his God, well, he's just one among many. Though Daniel's God is a conspicuous God and a particularly great God and a God who does great wonders, and his people are remarkable people. And Darius has got that far. Actually, it only makes him all the more guilty. What he sees and observes and understands about the true God and his work and his people ought to make a much greater impression on him. But he only recognizes the true God as one among many. Anyway, he respects Daniel, and he knows his reputation. Verse 3, after a while, you may know that Darius reigned only for something like 1 or 2 years, and then he passes from the scene, he dies, and Cyrus takes over everything himself. But while he was there, he's certainly not the worst of rulers. Then this Daniel, verse 3, was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. And that caused his great trouble and envy. And verse 4, Daniel, as the author of this chapter, writes it fairly tightly. You pass from one thing to another very swiftly with no wasted words. Then the presidents and princes, verse 4, sought to find occasion against Daniel. They wanted him to fall. And you can imagine there would have been an intensive investigation because Daniel had been functioning in rule to a greater or lesser extent in that city for decades. So there was a long history behind him. And you would think the investigators could have found something with which to accuse him, or disgruntled people who were willing to speak against him. They were probably quite an international crowd, I should imagine, among these subordinate rulers. There were many who were in position before, who, like Daniel, their service went back to Nebuchadnezzar, and well into his reign and lifetime, there would have been people who were captives from all the nations, like Daniel, many other Jews. There would have been many Chaldean nationals and many Assyrians who the Chaldeans had conquered. But certain Assyrians had been left in position of power. So they would have been quite an international crowd, these rulers, I would think. And then maybe they had imported some Medes and some Persians. But anyway, their investigation could find nothing, which is a tremendous testimony of the faithfulness and probity of the work that in connection with Daniel. For as much as he was faithful, and it means not so much to God, though he was, but in his work, neither was there any error or fault found in him. And then verse 5, you know the narrative. They realize that they cannot find any occasion against Daniel except in the practice of his faith. Now they had one thing in common. They hated the Jews among them. They hated them, at least the faithful Jews, because they regarded them as arrogant. They were not arrogant, I'm quite sure. The faithful and believing Jews who held office. We have Daniel and three others named in this book of Daniel, in the narrative passages. And there would have been others too. But they seemed arrogant to these polytheists, the pagans of the other nations, because they would not cross-recognize gods. Their God was an exclusive God, the only living true God. All other gods were idols and inventions and myths and absurdities. And however graciously they tried to win people to the one true God, their whole deportment and their attitude would have been regarded as an arrogance by them. And they hated them because of their standards and because of the Ten Commandments and the things to which they cleaved and the things they propagated. So there was great hostility. There was envy, but it's the old story. There's hostility against the true, faithful people of God. And it's stirred up by the devil. And sometimes they know not why they have such hatred and hostility. Because the devil's great aim is to destroy the line of the promised Messiah, to get rid of these faithful Jews and put them under persecution and destroy them. There's already been former attempts at genocide. So we're not talking about the nation as a whole, we're talking about the faithful. And from that, them would come the Messiah. So they knew. Now, Daniel would have lived, I expect, but this is speculation, in the ruler's quarter of the city. The city of Babylon had a whole section in it, which would have been devoted to all the rulers with their townhouses for those who lived elsewhere and had their seat of local government elsewhere in the empire. But they would have had their townhouses in that vast city. That was the scheme. And those who were resident, who were in the administration in Babylon, they'd have all lived in the same general area. And Daniel, and no doubt some of the other believing Jews, had a testimony. And they wanted it to be seen that they were people who depended for everything upon their God, upon the true and living God. Daniel appears to have had a kind of upper story chapel. And it had its windows constructed to face Jerusalem. That was because it reminded him, I would think, of the great hope that soon God would fulfill prophecy and the Jewish people would return, or at least a remnant of them, to Jerusalem, and there continue the testimony, and there would be another opportunity for them to serve God and flourish, and one day Messiah would be brought forth. That was his great hope, the return from captivity. That he knew the predictions well, he was a prophet himself. And so it was his practice, rather like us, going to church on the Lord's Day, to ascend into his private chapel with its long windows and to take up his prayers and petitions three times a day. He didn't do it out of some Pharisaical spirit just to be seen, but he did it in order to make a testimony. This Daniel, he might be the senior ruler under the king, under the emperor, but he's a humble man. And this is what Daniel wished to say, and he trusts his God, and he depends upon his God. Now, this decree that is concocted very cunningly by his enemies is going to prevent, or try to prevent, that from taking place. But they know that he'll defy it, and so it'll be the grounds of their accusing him. Well, this is verse 7. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors, princes, counselors, captains, have consulted together. Took them some time, I would imagine. Daniel would not have known. He might have picked up that this was going on, but he wouldn't have been involved, quite obviously. And they were concocting a royal statute, a firm decree, a binding prohibition or ban. And the scheme was, this has been described as ridiculous. It's not ridiculous at all. It's very clever. The idea was that there would be a 30-day ban on all petitions made to God or people to establish and to enhance and recognize the authority of Darius. I can imagine that one part of Darius suffered from a sense of inferiority. He was not of royal blood. He was not strictly a ruler. He was a military man. He was a general. He'd been put in a position of power, and to dress him up as a royal, they'd given him a throne name. That's why we know him as Darius in the book of Daniel, but that name Darius, at least not in regard to him, doesn't appear on any ancient inscriptions. He had a throne name. It's to dress him up. He's appearing a king. Well, he's got an international crowd. In those days, kings were the representatives of their gods. They were thought to be appointed by their gods. We shouldn't laugh at that. We had a very strong, strong belief in the divine right of kings in this country until only a very few centuries ago. You shouldn't defy the king. You cannot dethrone the king. You cannot, even Christian people, they had it in their systems, taught them from earliest years. The king is God's appointment. However wicked, however evil, you cannot raise a hand against the king. How much more in pagan days, days of polytheism, the kings were the representatives of the gods. Darius would have liked to have that status, was he not now, under Cyrus, virtual emperor of Babylon, but I think he had something of an inferiority complex. And the counselors and subordinate officers of state played to this. We think there ought to be a decree, and for 30 days, this is very early in his reign, for 30 days there will be no petitioning of people or gods except to the king. So the pagan feasts would all be drawn to a halt. The pagan temples in Babylon would be quiet for a month. You would not make a plea or cry out just out of deference to the king. Only the king's business for 1 month. This was a scheme to establish his status, his authority, his representation of the gods as king. Even to a fellow man, there mustn't be any great transactions, I would think, of land and business and other things changing hands on any scale. Only the king's business. Well, it's not seen anywhere else. We've never come across it before, so the experts tell us. But this is the scheme to vaunt Darius. While he had this inferiority attitude, on the one hand, it obviously appealed to him. On the other, he could pull himself up now. It played to his natural vanity and pride. His office was already going to his head. So yes, he'll sign it. He takes the bait. He'll have it. It's a highly intelligent ruse and scheme, and very plausible. Wherefore King Darius, verse 9, signed the writing and the decree. Well, Daniel knew the implications of it. And when he heard it, in verse 10, he went into his house, and with his windows, blinds, whatever, open, he continued, just as he always did, to give testimony to the fact that he depended upon God. And that is the application of his faith. He's not going to let that go. Just as we, I hope. Well, the people living in the former Soviet Union, when the persecution was going on. In the West, we used to talk about the underground church. Well, those persecuted Baptists, unregistered Baptists in the Soviet lands, they didn't like that term, and they weren't very keen on that term being used in the West. They would say, we're not an underground church. We're carrying on just as we did before. So while underground church has become fashionable in the West, it's not a thing they liked. There were some things that were underground. Those handmade presses were underground, most certainly. Some of the things they did were underground. Some of their larger meetings were conducted in rendezvous that were kept secret as much as possible. But their regular services went right on in their meeting places, subject to interruption, subject to the arrest of the pastors. It was their witness. They carried on like that. Even though the places would often be broken down, well, years ago, in the 80s and the 70s and 80s, we were seeing all the pictures, all the photographs of the places that were demolished and seized and so on. But they were not secret. And when I went to Moscow in 1990, when this had just, the persecution had just come to an end, well, I was in churches there that had been standing for years. They'd been demolished and rebuilt, timber structures, they'd been set on fire, they'd been moved or reconstructed, but they were still public worship going on, and this is the same with Daniel. Will he stop his witness and do it in hiding? No, he won't. It's his duty, he believes, to God. It is his faith. Verse 11, then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. I should think first the spy who was watching, and then the people were called, and they would all come, or at least a number of these rulers, so that they could give testimony and witness what was happening. You can actually translate, it appears, then these men assembled, as these men burst in, as some of the moderns do. It could go either way. So perhaps they did even burst in and manage his arrest. It doesn't actually say as much, but it could be along those lines. But then they approached Darius. There was some council of state in verse 12, and you see their cunning, because they want to clear the ground and make sure that the king is going to be faithful to his pledge and his law. They don't mention the name of Daniel. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Verse 12. Hast thou not signed a decree? And Daniel will report it. He wasn't there. He's not in the picture at this stage. He's kept somewhere. But they rehearsed the whole business of this ban on petitions and so on, until the king affirms, correct, that's the law, that's what I've signed. Only then, verse 13, after they formally charged Daniel. And they said before the king that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, and they do their best to make it as bad as possible, this one-time slave is the man who's defying you, who's raised his head in arrogance and is defying the king's decree. And they slander him. They say, he regardeth not thee, O king, which was not true. Daniel so regarded Darius, though he couldn't respect him as a polytheist, he so regarded him as the king and properly served him that the king had promoted him, not once, but twice. But then they accuse Daniel before the king and what he's done. The king, verse 14, is angry with himself. He's incensed at himself because he realizes he's been maneuvered into this. And in his vanity, he has taken this decree and espoused it and accepted it and signed it and enacted it. He's done this, and he realizes that far from serving his vanity and making him the big king, it's made him slave of his subordinates. They've caught him out. Their will is now going to be done. He's in their hands. They're in control. And he's furious with himself. He's been outmaneuvered, and he cannot do anything about it. Great cunning is always employed in the war against the saints, in the battle waged by the seed of the serpent against the seed of the woman, true believers in God and in Christ. And you see all that cunning here. We read, though we don't know in what form this took place, at the end of verse 14, that Darius laboured till the going down of the sun to deliver him. This does not seem to be arguing with the subordinates because of the way verse 15 begins. Then these men assembled unto the king. So what is he doing to try to get things changed? Perhaps he's consulting with his immediate helpers to see if by any trick of drafting any loophole can be found, any way out can be considered. Perhaps it's legal discussion behind the scenes, and they cannot get the king off the hook. And then the subordinates assemble, verse 15, unto the king, "No, O king," and they grind it home. They remind the king that he's committed to this thing. So verse 16, you see, you know the account. The king commanded, they brought Daniel, and they cast him into the den of lions. And the king said to him, "Thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee." He's Daniel's God, note. He's still a pagan. He still cleaves to his own gods. He's not giving up his own system. But he's a superstitious man, and he regards Daniel as something of a magician, as well as a prophet. Daniel has a remarkable history, but has he not been nominally described as the head of the Chaldeans and the Magi? Has he not been described as a magician? Of course he isn't. But this Darius, polytheist as he is, he has a tremendous awe. And he holds Daniel in awe, but he also thinks something. He has an ability to conjure up and to bring down wonderful things upon himself. So the words mustn't be taken to suggest to us that Darius is a pious believer. He's a superstitious man with a great respect for Daniel. Verse 17, a stone is brought, laid upon the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet, perhaps that was the custom, and with the signet of his lords, the main accusers, which is a way of affirming, yes, the law stands, it cannot and will not be interfered with. The king had a bad night in verse 18. If he took no food, neither were instruments of music brought before him, he couldn't sleep. He was furious with himself, furious with the accusers of Daniel, sorry for Daniel too, his best subordinate and counsellor, and for what he's done. What a fool I've been to play into the hands of these men. And then he rose very early in the morning, verse 19, before daylight, we assume, and went in a great haste to the den of lions, came to the den, cried with a lamentable, a shaking voice. He didn't know what to think and hope for. Oh, Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God whom thou servest continually able to deliver thee from the lions? He knew that it was because of his consistent faith in his God that Daniel had been brought into this position. And he hears this calm voice say from within, O king, live forever. The customary way of saying, may you have a long reign. My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lions' mouths, and they have not hurt me. So all is well. And Daniel preaches a little sermon. For as much as before him, innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Well, Daniel had actually disobeyed the king. He had defied the king. He was guilty of that. He had ignored the king's decree, all that he'd done. When he says, I've walked in innocence before you, he means in all matters of state. He's followed the code for believers. He's honoured the king. He's obeyed the civil power. He's respected it. And I'm quite sure he's even prayed much for it. The only exception is he has refused to do the bidding of the civil power where its commands conflicted with the moral standards and instructions of God, who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then he makes an exception and defies him. But in all other respects, he's behaved perfectly to the civil power. Though it's a wicked civil power, yet it's appointed by God, and he's obeyed it and respected it. The standard that we hold today was kept immaculately by Daniel in his day. Verse 23, then was the king exceeding glad for him, and commanded that they should take him out of the den. And it's the note of Daniel, because he believed in his God. Verse 24 troubles people. Do remember that this is not what God commanded. It's what Darius, the pagan king, decides to do. The king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel. I don't suppose that's necessarily the whole 120, but the ringleaders will do. And they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. Of course, if this had been Israel, and a just death sentence had been pronounced upon such people, it would not have been carried out on their children or their wives. This is in Babylon, and this is under the Medo-Persian rule. So don't blame the Bible that the children and the wives were killed. It's a pagan king. And the lions had the mastery of them, and the old writers usually judiciously point out that the lions were hungry. And they point that out in order to refute the nonsense which is spoken Well, they'd just been fed before Daniel was cast in, and that's why he survived. Well, yes, but they ate everybody else who was cast in, and with great vigour. Sorry to talk about that, but anyway, that's verse 24. Then, verse 25, King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages. Yes, but he's only the ruler of part of the Babylonian Empire. But there would seem to be some deal whereby either king, whether it was the minor king, Darius, or the major king, Cyrus, when they issued a special kind of decree, could issue it to the entire empire. Because that's what Darius does. He writes to all people, nations, and languages. I make a decree. This is the outcome of the miracle. God is very economical with his miracles. People want miracles to occur 5 minutes, every 5 minutes of every day sometimes. But in the Bible, God is very careful with his miracles, quite frugal with them. And there's usually some great purpose in them, as there was here. Look, verse 26, religious freedom, and it must be extended to the Jews. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear. Respect is given to the God of Daniel. He's not Darius's God, note. For he is the living God. Not all gods were living. You couldn't count on all the pagan gods, on any of them come to that, to make a response. He is the living God. And steadfast forever, stable always. He'll never be overcome in the mythology by another god. There'll never be a time when he isn't. Darius accords a great deal to the God of Israel. And his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. So, having witnessed this astonishing event, Darius is overwhelmed by God to the point of issuing this great decree for liberty and for freedom. He goes on, verse 27, he delivereth and rescueth, he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Just think as we close what this miracle achieved, dear friends. And this all stems from the instrumentality of Daniel. Through the faith of Daniel, who may not have known what was going to happen, he was a prophet. It may be, though he doesn't record it, that God intimated to him by vision or some means that everything would work out right. But nevertheless, he exercises his faith and he carries on his witness of worship, and he will not be dissuaded. Now, what came out of that act of faith? Well, a great deal of comfort for the remnant Jews, for the believing remnant, for the typical church and the true believers in their midst, because a general proclamation, stronger even than the one Nebuchadnezzar had made years earlier, went throughout the area, respect the God of the Jews. No ruler would have dared legislate or lift a finger or mount a persecution after a decree like that. So Daniel's faith accomplished the comfort of the people of God for a season. Of course, it projected his testimony everywhere. It wasn't just the people who happened to be in the ruler's quarter of the city who saw Daniel's devotions, because this decree mentions him by name and his deliverance from the power of the lions. So it established the testimony of Daniel, remarkably, that act of faith. And then you can see that it prepared the entire Jewish world for his great prophecies, because from chapter 6 we're going to turn into the prophetic chapters, the visions and the predictions. The prophets of God in ancient times were always authenticated, attested. What an authentication this is, that on the eve of the great visions, Daniel is spoken of throughout the empire and his miraculous deliverance. It's going to be part of his authentication. And then the enemies are destroyed. These people were powerful and cunning and hateful. And the ringleaders among them were destroyed by their own side. The way God works, it is amazing that the seed of the serpent destroyed the seed of the serpent, if you please, in this great war. And that gave considerable peace. And of course, the overriding reason, by Daniel's act of faith, the line of the promised seed was preserved. And the Saviour could still be born. And the Jews were still there. And their faithful remnant. So that's why I wanted to call this study, I'm over time, Accomplishments Through Faith. A final question. What does it take to stop our devotions? I'm afraid to say that Satan doesn't need a den of lions to stop us. Sometimes getting fascinated with some trivial stuff on the television just crowds out our devotions. Sometimes we're preoccupied with something that we should be laying to one side, that we're bothered about or thinking about or worrying about instead of praying. Sometimes just mismanagement of time. Sometimes a spell of tiredness. Satan doesn't need lions for us. With lions he couldn't stop Daniel. May we be unstoppable in devotion, love, and faithfulness to the Lord. Think of it. The accomplishments of faith. Let's close singing together the hymn 517.